charge we're not sure about.
Hi, and welcome to episode 99 of In Tech We Trust, one short of 100. What's with that? This week, we've got an interesting show, and on it, we have El Ricotron.
I'm back! Yay, thank you, guys. I missed
you. And we missed you. And we also have the indomitable or indomitable or some word that starts with an N and ends with a double, Gabriel Chapman.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Hey, it's going pretty good. And then we have a special guest, someone who's not been on the show before, Anthony Chow. I just met Anthony yesterday at the Intel Developers Forum. He came up and he said, hey, I want to be on your show. I said, okay, let's do it. And here he is.
That's all. I have drank a few beers and I talked to Mark on this like this.
That's all it takes.
It's really all it takes.
Hey, Anthony, speaking of beers, tell people what your handle is on Twitter.
My Twitter handle is VClouder and Beer. I told this story to Mark last night. My last name is Chow, Chow. So in the beginning, I call myself VClouder and Beer. And later on, when I get involved with cloud, I'm going to say, oh, it's a good idea to change it to cloud and beer, the two things I like. So I have been using this handle for a long time. I know I want to build some, what is that called, a name brand for myself, but I just, this VClouder and beer is already so deep in, I cannot change it. So I keep on using this.
Hey now. I feel your pain because the bacon thing, it's like to change it now, it just can't happen, even though.
You don't, yeah, it's a risky thing. I mean, and the guy who has Rick.
Word to the wise, choose your Twitter handle.
Yeah, and the guy who has Ricotron, man, it's just like, I can't take that.
Hey, so I've changed my Twitter handle several times, and it's never really worked for me. So I'm just going to stick with GoFarley now.
Oh, come on.
Vendor neutral. I don't want to be, you know, I can't be three-par Farley anymore. I just have nothing to do with it. And
you should have went with WT Farley, man. That would have been.
He did go with it.
I think I might have had it for a couple of weeks or something, and then I thought, "Is that the brand? Is that the brand that I want?" And the answer today is, of course, yes.
Not your father's Farley.
Not exactly. Your father's Farley. I think
that might be too long.
Hey, before we have too much banter, I wanted to talk to Anthony about the Intel Developers Forum because that's where we ran into. Actually, we ran into each other drinking beer afterwards. We didn't meet there. But what did you think of the show, Anthony?
It was pretty good. I see a lot of new things. But for me, since I come from a networking background, I was initially trying to look something about the data plane development kit. I didn't see much. And then I find Intel is preaching about the 5G as a networking next wave. So I see a lot of movement in that area. And also,
were there any presentations on that, or was it a dud?
I was only at the expo floor because I got in late. I was supposed to be in at 10:20, but because of the weather in SFO, my plane was delayed. I get there around 2:00. So I spent more time at the airport on the road than me in the Intel Developer Forum, but it's worth it. It's worth the time.
You might have spent more time at the after party than the event itself then.
No, I spend more time on the expo floor.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. But since you've got beer in your Twitter handle, that would be okay. That would be a badge of honor, you know.
Yes. And I like.
So I kind of thought.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I also like the place where we had the party. I went there twice last year's VMworld.
Yeah, Thirsty Bear. Everybody.
Love that. Everybody.
I'm not sure if I should say the name. That's why I refrain from saying that.
Oh, no. Yeah, so you just let it all hang out, man. It's fine.
Yeah, the beer is pretty good. And the food is good, too.
So did you have lunch? Did you go to the food trucks or anything? I went to the food trucks, and I went to, like, the Hawaiian food truck, and it was okay. I just thought the portions were a little bit small. You know, I walked all the way down there. The food trucks were a couple blocks away from the place. You know, and it was kind of like walking off. They had people holding signs, and you walked a couple blocks. And it's like, man, if you're going to walk a couple blocks, they should, like, give you two or three portions worth at least.
But it's a food truck. Couldn't it have just driven to you?
Well, you know,
I'm just saying, it is California, but it sounds like it's mobile. Hey?
It's San Francisco, you know, right on, you know, Moscone, right at Moscone there. Yeah, they probably should have just driven.
Drive the truck to the 10,000 people. You know?
Yeah, that's...
Don't make 10,000 people walk to the truck. Just saying.
Yeah. Well, I shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth either. It was free for me, so, you know, I shouldn't complain. Matt Brander hooked us up, and I think that's who hooked you up too, wasn't it, Anthony?
Yes, it was Matt, yes. Yeah,
good guy that, Matt. So thanks, Matt, if you're listening to this. Anyway, so it's a small show. In you know, a couple weeks, we're going to be at a big show. VMworld 2016 with the wonderful theme, what, be tomorrow, be yourself, be something, be whatever. I'm not sure what that all means. Be part of Dell, I think is what they should say. And what's going on to prepare for it? We talked a little bit about it last week. Rick, you had something that was that you brought up in the agenda. What's this?
VMworld 2016. Yeah, you know, a lot of people are getting ready for that. I know I'll be there. I think the whole core crew except Nigel will be there. You know, this will be, I think I counted my 15th VMworld. Ouch, that's a lot. And I count the Europe one separate, but. You know, a lot of our listeners will be there. I'll be there. I think we're scheming a recording in the Tech Talks area, the studio there. I think it's on my calendar. But anyways, a couple things. You know, I got a little snarky. I started picking on, like, well, I'm going to go to the general session, but, you know, the seats, oh my gosh, they always use crappy seats, and it's like an hour and a half. So if the seats are good, I'll stay for both. But if not, I'll start watching in the hang space or online. But I'm going to go with a new, fresh look at VMworld this year. I've looked at VMworld a lot over the years, but I really need to see what's next with them. I really have some questions, honestly. So hopefully the general sessions will help me sort that out. I made a silly little infographic on my personal blog. I was bored one night of my loose agenda, the parties I'll be at. Oh, by the way, if anybody wants to go to the Veeam party.
Hey now.
Hey now. Me and my 3,000 closest friends, which is our target attendance for that, you need your VMworld badge, and it's free for everyone. You just have to be at the Light nightclub at 8 o'clock or later.
Which night?
But anyways. Oh, yeah, good point. Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Tuesday at Light, and it should be nice. The party. I'm given 2.5 presentations there at VMworld, so I'm excited for that. And a couple parties. Staying the weekend. This will be interesting. I've been to Vegas 30 times. I don't think I've ever left the Strip.
Let's face it, though, Rickatron, the biggest party is going to be your birthday.
No.
Come on. Come on.
The big 4-0. I'm admitting that, guys. But... yeah, we're making a little birthday out
wait,
of it.
Wait a minute. So this is your 15th VMworld, and you're going to be 40. That means that if somehow, if VMworld lasts another 10 years, and who's to say, and if you go to all of them, you will have gone to VMworld for half your life.
Well, I'm counting the Europe one separate.
Oh.
So,
oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I should have known that. Yeah.
So, because... but nonetheless, the party, my birthday party, we're having a little lunch or something situation on Friday. But I'm actually looking forward to chilling there. We're going to go afield. We're going to go to Hoover Dam. We're going to go to Red Rock. Maybe.
Oh, Red Rock's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe the Grand Canyon. So, I'll be in Vegas for like a week and a half, which is a long time to be in Southern Nevada. We'll see if I don't get a little stir crazy.
So if it gets really hot, head up to Mount Charleston. It's about 20 degrees cooler up there.
Cool.
Nice place to hike. It's about an hour and a half drive, hour drive out of Vegas.
Yeah. Bring in the kids. I'm a little wiggy about that, but I'm not staying on an on-strip property. So I think that's going to be the right balance for my Midwestern style, but we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, well, they got to get exposed to that stuff sooner or later, Rick.
True. I agree. Might as well be with me. You know, I'm looking forward to it. You know, it's a lot of work for me as a sponsor. I know Gabe and I usually people just see us standing around the booth, but we actually do a lot of work in this this role.
Yeah.
This is probably the biggest event. I mean, what do you kind of look at, Gabe, with this one?
You know, I mean, this is kind of weird. I think my first VMworld was 2010, and then I've only been to the Europe one a couple times. I'm going to that one again this year, so I'll be doing both VMworlds. I actually have to do VMworld, and then I have to do Docker, or not Docker, OpenStack Summit back-to-back. So I'm going to be in Barcelona for 2 weeks.
Oh, that's it's like gonna the be, European, like, my European Vegas. I don't like it.
I will be, like, fully acclimated, and I will have never want to eat a tapa ever again.
That chastity belt where you keep your money is going to be rusted on by the time you leave.
But, you know, I'm going to spend, like, 2 weeks in Marriott Renaissance, you know, which is always good for points. But, you know, and then it's just funny. My travel schedule this year is just bonkers. It's different than any other year past. But, you know, that's a different topic. You know, the VMworld thing, I'm presenting. I think I have to present a session or two. And, you know, obviously I have VIP customer meetings. It's usually how we roll is we'll create a series of opportunities to have discussions with, you know, specific customers around larger, deeper dives around architecture and things of that nature, which I think are there's a lot of value because, you know, you don't normally, you know, get to see that many customers in one area all the time, so get as many of those as you can. And, you know, we are actually having a poker night with Dave Wright, and that's going to be fun. And
is he going to fleece all your customers? Isn't that great? Yeah, I went to play poker with the CEO, and he fleeced
I don't think he took
$600 off me.
I don't think we're going to use real money. I actually have to leave VMworld.
But he is a card shark, though, right?
Yeah. He's I wouldn't say he's a card shark, but I think he has gone to the high-stakes room. It should be fun. I got to leave early, and which is kind of nice because
nobody notices if you leave early. I call it the trip clip. You know?
Oh yeah, yeah. Almost. I mean, I have to go up to. I got a big QBR like that Thursday, so I got to leave, come home, then fly up to San Jose. It's just, it's been busy.
Why don't you get in the car with me and do a road trip back up? You know, we'll drive through the desert together and do some acid.
That's true. It is. And the funny thing is, it's not at the Venetian. I wasn't even thinking, and I booked a hotel that was behind the Venetian.
Oh, yeah, good.
So now it's like a whole mile away, and I'm like,
take the tram up.
Yeah, there we go.
That wonderful tram. Hey, so let's move on with the agenda here. We're going to talk about car stuff. Interesting things going on with cars. Tesla again in the news with another accident, this time in China. Ford is going to deliver a driverless car, they say, in 2021. And that's going to be interesting. You know, we'll talk a little bit about that. There's some interesting little tidbits about that. And then there was this big hack at the NSA, right? And it's one of these things like, should this be in the news or not? And of course it's in the news. But when the NSA gets hacked, it's really interesting. And the secrets that are given out, they could be dangerous and it could be the right thing to be doing. So we want to talk about that a little bit. We want to talk about, speaking of hacks, we want to talk about the hackathon in Australia where a couple of students built a website that is apparently much better than the government's the Bureau of Statistics or their census website where people have just been crying about how lousy that is. Kind of interesting that two guys at a hackathon would outdo a $10 million project by the government. We'll talk a little bit about Rubrik. Rubrik got $61 million of C round funding. You know, is it time for that or not? We're going to talk about how SGI has now gone away. It's been swallowed up by HPE. It looks like it's just basically buying up the intellectual property and a few customers. And then sort of the big news, Lauren's not here. Otherwise, it would be so much fun to have her on to talk about the news that Cisco's planning to lay off, depending on what you read, 5,500 employees or as many as 14,000. I think the 14,000 is a little high, but that's the thing. You guys ready to go?
Let's rock it.
Okay. So back to cars. There was another accident with Tesla, this time with a guy in China. And, you know, he says that autopilot let him down and he sideswiped another car, ran into another car. No injuries this time. Nobody was killed. But all the way across the other side of the world, Tesla's trying to, you know, figure this out, looking at the telemetry data that they have, and they're saying, buddy, you don't know how to drive our car. Anybody else read anything about this or know what's going on?
I did read that article, and it was much less detailed than the one situation of the guy from Ohio and that had the crash of the left turn situation. And, you know, we don't have details of, like, the motion and, like, a diagram of what happened. But, you know, there are going to be anomalies of this technology, but I don't think that this technology will have to be stopped. But I think that, the way that Tesla or anybody with an autopilot or self-driving technology needs to handle this is to really put in more handling for these types of situations. So I don't think we really know, you know, the full scope, but the thought of the driver not doing it right, even on autopilot mode, that's kind of concerning, because I'd really want some sensory type things on a car to prohibit idiocracy.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion.
Hey, so Anthony, not that you drive there, but you may have some insights into driving in China. Do you have any, or, you know, what do you have any thoughts about this?
I have not been in China nor in Taiwan, but I heard story on a three-lane road. If there is space, we can have five cars concurrently driving on that road. But that could be many years ago. Nowadays, it's different.
Well, I've also, correct me if I'm wrong, is the mainland China is mostly first and second generation drivers also. Is that a fair statement? So that they're not, you know, I don't have my dad teaching me how to drive. I just figure it out, or that type of thing. You know what I mean? Is that?
See, I think unlike America, driver, the pedestrian has the higher priority or the right of way. I think in Asia country, the car has a better voice. One time I was in Hong Kong, it was maybe 20 years ago. I was on the sidewalk, on the pedestrian walking. There was a two-lane street. One car is trying to make a right turn, which blocked all the cars behind him. And then one car, all of a sudden, drove up to the pedestrian and then just drive around the car that is trying to make a turn and then move on. I was on the pedestrian. I was surprised that the car will come up, and there was just scare me too. That was one of my experience.
Kind of like a survival of the fittest thing. The machines are going to win.
And then, but with one comment about the car, software meant to have bugs. But in the expense of someone being killed, I think that's a little bit excessive. And I think they should put more control on that so that there can be an override or something in the initial phase where the software is not that robust. At least this is my opinion on the self-driven car.
Well, I think the issue is that the expectation of the driver was different than what Tesla says that it states about the car. Right now, the name of the function is called autopilot, and you can read a lot into that. And I think the driver thought the car actually would steer itself, because from what I've read, you know, Tesla's saying he didn't even have his hands on the wheel at the time that the accident took place. And I think his argument is the car is supposed to drive itself. Right. And so there's this huge gap between what Tesla thinks people ought to know about driving and what people think they're hearing from, you know, a car salesman.
Mm.
I think that, yeah, there might be definitely an anomaly in how it would exit autopilot. I know that the Honda cars have this mechanism that'll carry you on here in the States on cruise control on a highway, for example. But if you don't touch the wheel or something in so much time, it starts beeping and will take it off of cruise control, but it's not going to stop the car.
Okay. My car does that. It doesn't stop the car, but it'll, like, I can push this button when the cruise control's on, and or even when I'm driving and it's lane assist, it'll steer my wheel back into to the right lane. It's kind of annoying sometimes when it's on, because, like, maybe I don't want to. Maybe I'm trying to go into that lane, and it's like it kind of forces your hand a little bit. It's not a natural action.
But if you,
maybe you're having a pulmonary embolism.
Or what if you climbed in the back seat to, you know, smack your kid or get your phone? You're gonna hit something. If it.
Oh yeah, what a drag would be if you're like beating up on somebody else in the car, and it's like auto-correcting for you when you're just trying to freak them out.
Yeah, or exactly. Or it's like you totally abandon the responsibility of that front left seat, then those types of things might happen.
Gotcha. This brings me a point on yesterday's Intel Developer Forum. They're showing lots of Internet of Things, IoTs, and they said in America and part of Europe, lots of the road have those sensors that can sense the car, and then they can do analytics on the information they gather. And I think this might help later on to refine the driving experience.
They're saying that the road's smart? The road has sensors in it?
Yes, that's what I heard from the guy at the booth. I'm not sure how accurate it is.
Maybe in Norway or something. I mean, what do you think? Gabriel, what do you think? Do we have smart roads?
I don't know, man. There's no smart roads around me.
We don't have them, but I know there's a concept technology for incredibly smart roads.
I think they'll have to be if we ever get to that self-driving car space, is we're going to have, you know, I don't know how they'll ever do it because it's hard enough to fill a pothole. But to re-architect your infrastructure and road systems to accommodate what you would probably want to do in terms of a self-driving vehicle, the way they've been envisioned in the past, would require some significant spending that nobody has money for.
My next comment will show my age. ever watch about the show? What did they come think of next?
Well, yeah, well, what will they think of next? I mean, yeah, the smart car, the smart road, yeah. But they're still dumb people. So I don't know what to say.
Yeah, it's going to take a PhD now to fill a pothole because you're going to have to rewire all of the intelligence in the road.
And software developers.
And software developers, which you are, Anthony. And I think you are looking for a job right now. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Well, try not to blow your prospects here on this show. So,
yeah, we're trying not to hurt that process there for you.
We're trying not to impact you negatively. So the other thing going on with driverless cars is Ford came out this week, today actually, and they said we're going to develop a level 4 driverless car by 2021. We're going to bring it to market, and that means that the car won't have pedals or a steering wheel. Truly, you know, it's like a passenger seat instead of a driver's seat. You guys read about this?
No, but I see a demo on a wheelchair where a guy is looking at a sensor, and then by sticking out a tongue or making a half smile, the wheelchair will move according to the desire of the occupant. I think this should be something doable.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen those kinds of things too. I think the target market for this is actually Uber and Lyft, and they want to bring it out, you know, in I think primarily large cities where there's a lot of traffic congestion. And, you know, the idea is that you'll have a car that's almost more like a bus and you'll get in it. And I'm not sure how you communicate your coordinates. There will probably be an app for that. There has to be an app for that. And you get in this car without a driver and it takes you there. The curiosity is that, you know, how many of these things will they have to have on the road and how will they have to prove it before passengers will actually buck up and get in these things?
Well, I think it's inevitable. I've always thought Uber driver is a temporary job. There's going to be, you know, Uber drone that'll take people and stuff, people, places, and things like that. The thought of a car that will, you know, have that. I mean, I think the better analogy is like a plane train that's at an airport. You know, there's no drivers in those. They're on a predefined track, but something as broadly applicable as an Uber pickup is really attractive. And then also deliveries, I think, you know, Amazon or courier type services, those type might have a use case for that, car share, whatever.
Oh, that would be a good
idea. I mean, there's incredible potential for this fourth generation, driverless car or, you know, smart car. And I think, you know, they put a very far out date, 2021, I think is what they said, something like that.
Yeah, 5 years.
Yeah. And I think that's, honestly, I really think that's aggressive because you're going to see some places where that's going to work and some places where it might not. Like, I'd love to see a self-driving car go in like a Michigan winter or something like that. You know, it's just not going to work. Things like that, right? So I think there's still some anomalies, or at night in a snowstorm, right, that are going to cut off the full broad applicability of this. But where it's going, I'm all in, and I'm all for this type of technology.
Hey, so I wonder if, you know, if it's going to be used by Uber and Lyft and, you know, services like that, if they'll have some sort of telepresence built in. So if you need to talk to somebody, you'll be able to do that, you know, a control center, a Lyft control center, an Uber control center somewhere where people can talk to you if you need to have that discussion.
Well, I'm sure that's going to be an idea, but I think that, you know, maybe even just a phone call would work, but I don't know if proper telepresence is needed.
The user interface is always necessary, and it's good for
customers. Yeah, but then if you think about the complexity of the car, make the user interface the passenger's phone, because then you have to have less interface on the car, is my thought. But, you know, you could go either way with that. But there would need to be some, well, especially if there's some passenger determined situation that they need a GTFO of this car, there's going to be a way to make that car to somehow make it stop or get out of it.
That would be the model for the car, the new Ford GTFO.
GTFO, that's right.
Hey, so let's move on to the next item, which is the NSA being hacked. And this is a really interesting story. If you don't mind, I'm just going to go with it. This week, a group of hackers came out and started publishing information about things that they found apparently hacked from the NSA. And security experts have looked at it and they've said, yeah, it looks like it's probably legit. And at the root of it is that the NSA has had tools to hack into major products' firewalls, and they've been using it for 2 to 3 years. So the hacking toolkits have been available. The NSA has been using it. Their advanced technology group that does this hacking has been using it, and now it's exposed. And the group that found these tools has put out, or they said that they'll sell them to the highest bidder for Bitcoin. I think it's, 10 million Bitcoin or something like that. Most people that are familiar with that say, actually, that's probably a ruse because that could be tracked. But the fact is, there is somebody that's looked at the NSA spying on them or someone else and is making that public. And it brings up a couple of very interesting points. The first one is, if there are products that are in production that are, used commercially, and if the NSA knows there are vulnerabilities in there, is it right for the NSA to not say anything to anybody, but to sort of feel like they've got an upper hand and to continue to try to exploit those vulnerabilities when, in fact, they could be used by someone else too? Anybody have any thoughts on this?
Well, you're asking two different questions. Do they, or is it right? And they're going to have different answers.
Yeah. So go ahead, Rick. You asked the first one.
I think they do, but I also don't think it's their. I don't think it's the NSA's business to say, "Hey, Cisco, or I don't know, Fortinet, or whatever products are out there, Untangle firewall that I use, whatever." I don't think it's the NSA's business to report that to them. Whether or not they use it is another discussion.
Well, zero day exploits, I mean, that's the bread and butter for hackers and people who are doing nefarious things. And it's kind of one of those things that, like, if you find one or you can leverage one, you keep it close to the vest and you don't let it out, because if you do, then somebody else can use it or they'll patch it.
But, I mean, it's not like the NSA is going to use it to move money.
No, they're just going to use it against...
just kill people. It's going to use it for intelligence.
You never know about that part, but...
Well, it's intelligence. So I think that the kind of justifiable element is for I don't have any people there or anything, but it's for what I would call the greater good. It's for intelligence and such. It's not for...
Right, but it also has to be within legal reason or legal means too. And if they're taking advantage of something that they've discovered illegally, it's no different than a citizen doing it.
No, that's a good point.
And it's not like the rules don't apply to them, except unless you're Hillary Clinton.
Oh, there we go.
The data center's out on a boat out in the ocean, so it's not in the U.S. So
there,
the
you go.
Don't apply.
Right.
There you go.
Yeah, that's what the Google boat was all
Google
about.
Boat.
Right?
That's right.
I know. All these things are always a slippery slope, and I'm always hesitant to be supportive of some of those things if there's not good oversight. And frankly, I don't think the people who are in Congress are smart enough in many respects, especially given the people that have been long-time tenured on our National Security Council and whatnot. It's just, a lot of the same, or they just don't know, or they're ignorant, or they're not.
Oh, a lot of them want back doors in the systems, Gabriel. Let's face it. I mean, they're not smart about this stuff. They don't think this stuff will go wrong. I mean, this is an interesting case in point where you know, the NSA, you know, the top information gathering in, you know, institution in the U.S. shrouded in a lot of secrecy. You know, a lot of their secrets were exposed by Edwin Snowden. But the fact is, these guys are the best of the breed, if you will, and they screwed up and they left their tools out there and they were discovered. I mean, it's going to happen. Right. You can't think that you
or
are
maybe
so
they
secret.
Did it on purpose.
Maybe they did it on purpose.
People don't realize if the Tor was developed by the Navy. No wonder they had back doors.
Right. Yeah. No, one of the things, right, is, you know, some of the names of these tools were kind of interesting. I don't know if you saw any of those, Gabriel. One of them was what?
Epic Banana. Oh, Extra Bacon. I like that one.
Yeah. Extra Bacon.
That one's for Gabe, everybody. Yeah.
Delicious. Yeah. You can never go wrong with extra bacon.
Something with beer, too?
There was something with beer, too. Yeah, there was. Yeah. There was banana, bacon, and beer. There were, you know, names associated with those. So, Anthony, you're a coder, and you got a chance to look at it. Did all this seem like it's all – the story's all legit? You know,
it seems legitimate because it follows the classic steps in hacking, where they first do the reconnaissance, knowing what the target is and what kind of operating system it is using, and then they will try to do the known exploit of that system or that version of the software.
But is it too legit to quit?
What the hell?
You're showing your age, Gabe. There you go.
Hammer time.
This is important to implement the defense in depth concept, where like a castle, you have the high wall and also you have the river around it, so that when one is being breached, the other one can also save prevent the hacker from entering into the castle. So just one firewall is not enough, and they have to implement the defense in depth, so that even though we have the firewall has been exploited, they still cannot break into the core. But another problem with the hacker is that we have to win 100% of the time, where the hacker only needs to win one time.
Yeah, when you think about it, you know, any plan that you have is going to be broken. Whatever you think you've got, somebody's going to get through. That's just the way it is, sooner or later.
Especially the maker. The people who make stuff, they know how to work around it.
Hey, so let's move on to, speaking of people that know how to do clever things, let's move on to a couple of guys in Australia that seem to have outdone, you know, a big government project for the census over there. I don't know if anybody else has seen the complaints on Twitter. You know, the Australians are about howling about how lousy the census website is over there. And apparently the Australian government, the Bureau of Statistics, spent about $10 million. And apparently there were a couple of guys that went to a hackathon, and for the equivalent of something less than $1,000, closer to $500, they built a system that appears to be much better. Anybody read up on this stuff? Is there any credibility to this story, or is it just like weirdness from down under?
No, I read the story that we shared, and I think that there's absolutely a benefit when you can come in with a set of requirements and deliver something that's awesome without any predetermined, you know, handicaps that might be what is traditionally assigned to government infrastructure. So, you know, $500, 54 hours, they have something that can do it. You know, the only thing that can really, you know, challenge something like this is things like identity management, right? Because then the next thought is, well, can we use something like this for voting, you know, or something like that? But no, I think this type of innovation is great. You're going to see these types of things happen, and I think governments and the like should really do these types of things, sponsor innovation and incubate. I think this is awesome.
Hey, so Rick, are you saying that you think that the government was handicapped because they had like old systems and old ways of doing things that they sort of had to use?
So I'm not so specific familiar with the Australian,
sure,
you know, governments and stuff. I've been there a number of times. In fact, I was going to be there this week, but I had to trade with a colleague, but he's in Australia right now. But the thing is, generally speaking, I see governments, some governments, a couple of technology generations behind where everybody else is. So there's a handicap, right? Well, we got to get the data here. We got to get it from here to there, that type of thing. So these artificial like constraints kind of get in the way sometimes. Whereas if you, you know, simulated disaster and everything was destroyed, how are you going to do it another way? And I think that this is an opportunity when you have these incubation or hackathon type experiences. I think incubator would be a better word because they're not hacking. They're trying to make something, right? But the hackathon word works. But the thought was building something without any predisposed limitations. I think it's really awesome when they can do that.
Well, I mean, I think part of the thing here was this too, is it's like, you know, all right, it's a good clickbait headline. I think if you dive deeper, there's probably a little bit more to it, you know, in terms of what they had to do. But showing the illustration of what they can do, and really, to me, the whole thing was a commercial for serverless, which is a Lambda, you know, the AWS Lambda stuff. But it shows the power of what you could do with a cloud-based solution that scales. Now, on the flip side to it is, how secure is the data? There's a whole bunch of unknowns and questions in there that, you know, just showing the fact that you can fill out a census form online as something simple is probably fairly simple and easy. There's a bunch of governance behind it, and the reason why these things take so long. And obviously, you know, there's control of data and information and where it sits, and you're not going to do all this in Amazon. But you can't. I mean, I think that I was reading the article, I'm like, all right, this is pretty awesome. I mean, they did this for $500, but they took one aspect of it and they didn't take all the other risks associated with it into context as well. So it's not a apples to apples comparison. It is something that is, you know, to the layperson, yes, it's functionally the equivalent, but there's something else behind that.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, this group of the government, I don't remember what ABS is. It's like
Australian Bureau of Census or something like that.
Yeah. There was a huge tech
statistics.
Fail.
Australian Bureau of Statistics, sorry.
That's right. There was a huge tech fail. Basically, it was a web-driven service. They had used IBM, and it just fell over. And whatever, they failed to get a census due to technology infrastructure. And you know what? We've had other things like, you know, a couple of U.S. airlines had some big outages recently, but this was a technology census, a government function that failed due to technology. So literally, as far as I know, there was, you know, a lot of money spent and no census, or at least not a complete census.
Yeah, I mean, if you start to look in the details of some of the stuff, I mean, there was a requirement that the data had to reside physically in Australia. So, yeah, I don't think there's an AWS zone there. So, you know, they couldn't have done that if the government wanted to. You know, like I said, it's kind of interesting that they were able to spin this up as fast as possible as they could. Like I said, it's just those details in the background that we don't get to really – aren't really necessarily privy to.
Well, you know
– it makes it a good clickbait article and a good illustration of what, you know, cloud computing is capable or public cloud computing is capable of. But, you know, it's –
Well, I want to call foul there for a second, because just because there's no Amazon zone in Australia yet doesn't mean that they can't take a cloud approach.
I'm not saying they can't take a cloud approach. They just don't. There's no, you know, would they be able to, they wouldn't be able to do this on anything else other than Amazon in the time that they did using the tools that they did.
There's a lot of the only group that
provide this, right?
They could have spent some money on a SolidFire array.
There's a lot of really robust service providers in Australia.
Well, no, I mean, you got there are a good number of them, right? But they're not. They are not offering. No one is offering what Lambda
does. They've built
an
app around Lambda.
Okay. I mean, yeah, there's cloud providers that will let you spin up a workload. So yes, theoretically, the Australian government could have built a cloud service based model on a local cloud provider in Australia and done it maybe cheaper than trying to host it themselves. Who knows? But the thing is, it really, like I'm trying to reiterate here, is this is nowhere near close to being an apples to apples comparison. But like I said, it was a good, interesting headline.
That it was. And with that, we should move to our next headline, which is Rubrik getting $61 million in a Series C. And it seems like a lot of money. Puts them up, what, about $111 million or something like that over three rounds. And the CEO, Bipul, says that, you know, they're, you know, doing 100% growth quarter after quarter. Is that a thing? I mean, do you think that's the right story? Do you think that they're trying to get enough money so they can last through this trough of economic uncertainty in the U.S. election cycle and all of that? What's going on?
So if you look at a couple things, you're not going to see a whole lot of infrastructure startups getting funding unless they have a model that's working, unless they can illustrate and show that they have a chance or to even be remotely cash flow positive or a few other things. So the ones that are getting funding in this particular market are things I think to watch. Personally, I'm not really wild or interested in the backup or secondary storage space.
Hey,
he's fighting words.
It's not an area that I'm interested in. You know, it's one piece of a 100,000 piece puzzle. But you know, there's a large attack surface associated with that market that you can go after and make a decent living at. And we saw them do it with Data Domain. And then you kind of have that platform and I think another one, Something Grid or whatever, maybe a little bit long in the tooth, and it's time to maybe build the better mousetrap. And so you have three or four companies that are doing that. You have Cohesity, you have Rubrik, and you have Reduxio.
Well, you know, I think it's important to note that there's a market for smarter storage for backups. My concern is that, and full disclosure, sometimes I compete in what I do with Rubrik, but it's one of those things that what you have as a different tier in a smart backup target, I think is a natural extension of what's happening in the primary storage route, because there's a phenomena that anybody in the data availability space will agree with, that there's smart storage out there today. There's smart servers and smart applications. When that all goes wrong, people really want their crap back swiftly. So anything you can do backwards, smart backup applications, smart storage for the backup storage, whatever, you really have that same expectations of availability when things go wrong. So, you know, I'm all for innovation in that space. And, you know, like the fact that Cohesity and Rubrik are really similar in that space, I'd say 75% similar, tells me that there's really an emerging market for that type of thing.
So the question then is, do you think Cohesity is going to get a round like that? Do you think they need a round like that? Do you think they need something to be able to compete with Rubrik? And if so, will they get it? My guess is they won't. They're probably not doing as well and unlikely to get funding at the same level. Of course, a lot of funding doesn't mean that you're necessarily doing right either. It was about a year ago, I think people were looking at the funding that Data Gravity had, for instance, and I don't want to pick on those guys, but there are other companies. It's like they got a lot of funding, you know, close to $100 million. Where are they today? In trouble. Right.
Right. That's true.
But there's a lot of people that got a lot of money that
true.
Are in trouble.
Yeah.
And it's just because, you know, I'll tell you right now, man, as somebody who's gone through an exit recently, there aren't a whole lot of them left. There may only be, you know, two or three in the infrastructure, the physical appliance model based.
Investors are not interested in infrastructure. They're not.
No, nobody gives a rat's ass. It's boring. It's all commodity. The money or the future is in the software. It's eating the world. I mean, that's really what we're preaching. And there, and not to say that there isn't, you know, that you don't have to make some short, you have to take some shortcuts bringing your product to market as an appliance at first and then pivot to software. And that's what you're seeing is kind of the go-to-market model right now, or at least you're seeing some of the last gasps of that model as a lot of companies that would have been naturally a software-only play had to build something that was in a box and then deliver it to market, because that's how you get top line revenue and how you can get, you know, a quicker route to market and consistency and supportability and all these other things. It's only when you get to a certain level or growth or maturity that you're able to make the pivot to the actual end game. I tell you right now, I think there's half a dozen startups out there that are in this space, and especially on hyperconverged, that isn't the end game for their technology. It is a very different they had a very different vision in mind, and some of these are steps, you know, along that path.
Well, that vision's very important, Gabe, because the biggest caution that I would put in this space is anybody who is trying to be too many things to too many people as a 1.0 or a 2.0 product, hardware, software, whatever. That's my big caution.
No, I get that too, and I think, like I said, if you're over your ski tips or whatever, the market will respond accordingly. You know, there's some really cool technologies out there in companies that have been well capitalized that have sub 100 customers. That is not
over your ski tips. I'm not following you.
That's a saying, out over your skis, where, you know, your business vision, your plans, what you think you can do exceeds the market's ability to absorb.
You've written a check your ass can't cash.
Oh, okay. It's like a buffet of food. Got it.
Yeah.
Your eyes are bigger than your plate.
Yeah, you're trying to do too much. So speaking of being out over the skis, or maybe the opposite of that, this week HPE bought the remains of SGI. SGI, a company that once was, you know, one of the four big system companies, but SGI was really the killer in anything related to CGI and what is today, you know, virtual reality, augmented reality. They laid all the groundwork for that stuff. And here we go, a couple decades after they started, it's only worth $275 million. Whew, brutal.
Well, it's a good deal for Hewlett Packard. I mean,
I don't know. What are they really getting from it? I suppose intellectual property.
Maybe it's a really good like office venue in Northern California. I mean, that's probably, you know,
SGI sold their offices or gave them or left, and Google now inhabits a lot of the old SGI buildings. It was great space up there. It was at the end of Schoenbaum. Okay.
Well, that was a guess. I just figured, yeah, because they were old school NorCal, they might have had some you know, assets in regards to property, but. You know, intellectual property, you know, I don't know. Maybe they have a plan with that.
Well, there's the HPC space where they're still relevant, right?
And yeah, they only did I don't mean to belittle it too much. It was like $500 million or something last year. And, you know, and HPC that's a tough business.
No, and it's very tough business. But it's also, you know, it's also big. It's long sales cycles, but it's big.
Yeah, and it involves the government, big government contracts.
Yeah, it's niche or niche, as Nigel would say, with a lot of zeros at the end of the deal.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely can be very fairly lucrative, but it's also very commodity based in some respects. And then there used to be a time when there were a bunch of like proprietary interconnects that were all competing with each other. Most people don't remember Mirinet. You know, and things like that.
I don't.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, it powered one of the top three supercomputers in the world at one time. You know, and that's, you know, there's those. I mean, InfiniBand's kind of dominated that space, and you know, for the most part now today, that's really what they run as a connectivity technology. But it's still interesting, and there's still money to be made. And if there's a margin in there and it's profitable, somebody will address that market.
Okay, really rando off comment thing. So I'm looking at the SGI page, their 2100 series 2U server. It already has the HP like color on the drives. So do you know that little kind of like,
maybe they were rebranded.
Yeah, do you know that like kind of red and like almost brown color for
there are very defined.
But do you know that
colors.
That color has a name. It's called port, like a wine. Yeah. Yeah. Calvin Zito taught me that. But anyways, it looks like the SGI servers are already got the port little drive buttons. So I think they're
It's all over the front page there.
Well, it was once a big thing. I remember those big purple servers, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Star Wars movies
ILM
were made.
I mean, a lot of stuff was built with ILM.
Movies that we all love were done on Silicon Graphics gear, and it's gone. And then now to our last piece of news, but one of the closest. Cisco's got a layoff coming. And when it first was reported, you know, the numbers were like 14,000, and now it looks like it's been scaled back to 5,500 or 5,000 or something like that. It's still a lot of people. And, you know, the the idea is that they're trying to be more of a software company than a hardware company. I wish Lauren was here to talk about this or implicate herself in this. Because the question.
Oh, she told us what to say.
What did we say? What are we supposed to say?
No comment. That's what she said.
Okay, Rick, so what do you say, not what does Lauren say?
Well, you know, those are big numbers. Yeah. And I understand that companies need to retool and right the ship. You know, that's one thing I've learned in my professional career is that you have to be adaptable, because what is the decision today and, you know, 5 years down the line is, you know, that things are going to change. And I'm Googling as I'm talking here. I'm looking for the approximate number of employees that Cisco have. And, 71,000, according to Wikipedia. That's a lot of employees. But I look at laying off 5,000, 6,000 people, whatever, or more. I mean, I put it in my own little world terms. That's like two Veeams. Okay, that's a lot of people, but 71,000 people, that's a lot. So this is anywhere from less than 10% or more. You know, if you think about less than 10%, that's not a huge number, but it looks a lot in that regard. So, you know, whatever different types of businesses could be affected, business units, a company this size has different business units that are, you know, more or less affected, you know, maybe certain product lines to, I don't know. They don't really give information in these situations of where these types of things happen. But it's truly unfortunate because, you know, Cisco's making money. That's the unfortunate thing when you have to have this. Usually layoffs happen when a company is not making money. So it's sad. It happens, unfortunately. But, you know, this might be one of the first Chuck Robbins moves, right? How long has it been since he took over from Chambers? A year or so now, eh?
I think so, yeah.
So, you know, if you think about that big of a ship turning course, you know, these types of things might all be related.
Yeah, I kind of think of it that way too, Rick. I mean, they're trying to not be the next or not be another SGI. SGI did not navigate these waters. Cisco knows there's a lot of change going on. They're trying to figure out how to navigate it. They need to change, if you will, the culture, the way people think about themselves, the way people think about the company, so they can prioritize, you know, their own work, their own goals, all of that. And there's nothing like saying we're changing this company than laying off a bunch of people and saying we're changing this company, right? It really gets the message across.
Yeah, I agree with that. And because I hate to say it, you know, people resources are very important in a company. And there is a certain reality that you just cannot retool people to significant changes in the market. That being said, you know, maybe you can retool some, but not all. So that's a reality. And, you know, training stuff aside that are available, there are a lot of people that get into jobs as lifers, as I like to call it, and they can't take change. And, you know, that's when these types of things happen.
I mean, you know, I mean, it's the same size as I think the last set of layoffs that Cisco did. Company was 75,000 people. You know, wasn't Lee Iacocca said that is your Lee or who's the guy that Jack Welch at GE? You know, said within any organization there's 30% dead weight that you could probably get rid of tomorrow. And I think that that's probably pretty fair assessment for a company of that size. You know, you have product lines that don't work or that don't have much of a future or need to be depreciated. You have engineering staff that have been long tenured that are expensive that could be replaced at 5-to-1 cost reductions. There are economic decisions to make in organizations of that size and scale. And everything's based on the price of the stock, and that's what motions are done to move these days.
Who knows how many people they're hiring at a different division?
Maybe exactly.
That's my point. Yes.
Everybody gets a chance to apply for a different job in the first month, from what I was reading, and then if you can't get one, then there's a severance package, and that's more than fair. You know, that's really nice. I've been in places where I've taken a pay reduction and then simply been laid off. So
it's Cisco.com, not Cisco.org. And that's what it comes down to is, you know, they have to run a profitable business which includes substantial growth. There's high expectations on Cisco also. That's the other thing. You know, they just can't have, oh, good, we're 3% up for the year. That's not good enough for that level. So they have to be aggressive and you know, retool, readjust to market conditions. And it's a reality of business. It's not personal. It's business. How about that one?
I think that summarizes that pretty well. Anthony, it's been great having you on the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for helping me today, tonight.
Whenever
yeah,
it is.
Yeah. Nice meeting you.
Well, thanks for coming on, Anthony.
And everybody else, thank you too. And we'll try to do this again next week for episode 100. Oh.